says one way to end the violence in Syria could be through greater economic pressure.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, good morning. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Now the global perspective on business and economics. Syrian troops today opened fire on thousands of protesters in several cities across the country. The violent crackdown comes as the Muslim holiday of Ramadan wraps up. Meanwhile, officials from the 27 countries that make up the European Union meet today in Brussels to talk about expanding sanctions against the Syrian government. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us live from London with the latest on that story. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
So what sanctions are we talking about here?
A ban on doing business with Syrian companies that support the Assad regime. Specifically, they're talking about Syrian companies in banking, telecoms and energy. EU ministers have already reached a preliminary agreement on an oil embargo against Syria. Details of that are still being hammered out. Final agreement is expected on the whole package by the end of this week.
Is this going to have any effect, Stephen?
Of course, there's always doubt about the effectiveness of economic sanctions. For example, although Syria sells 90% of its crude oil to the European Union, analysts point out China and India, who are not party to this sanctions package, would probably be happy to buy the oil instead. But as Chris Phillips of the Economist Intelligence Unit told the BBC, the EU sanctions could have some effect.
It might actually persuade some members of the regime to turn on the leadership, recognising that the economic consequences of them staying in power in the long run will damage the economy.
The US, by the way, has already imposed its own oil embargo and a ban on American companies investing in Syria.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thank you.
Okay, Steve.
And while the EU eyes sanctions on Syrian oil imports, in Egypt, the petroleum sector is one of the few areas flourishing in the month since the ousting of President Hosni Mubarak. The economy's been pretty dicey there, yeah. Reporter Julia Simon has more from Cairo.
The large blue iron gate opens as a few businessmen enter the Egyptian Ministry of Petroleum. 23-year-old lawyer Ali Mohamed Ibrahim is rushing on his way to the ministry.
After the revolution, Egypt has changed, and any person or company should be able to visit the minister.
Good luck, I tell him. The revolution hasn't made Egypt's oil and gas sectors any less busy. Angus Blair of the Egyptian investment bank Beltone Financial says that's no surprise.
The hydrocarbon sector is probably the most immune to political change. Oil companies have seen change all over the world, and they're used to it.
About 15% of Egypt's GDP comes from oil and gas, or about $31 billion a year. Since the revolution 6 months ago, investment in those sectors has held up, but other areas like real estate and tourism have seen sharp declines. Tom Voidovich is the Egypt country manager for Houston-based energy company Apache Corporation.
We've reached this pace of about $1 billion a year, and that works comfortably for us.
Apache is the largest American investor in Egypt and just reported two new oil wells in Egypt's western desert.
They would be the 12th and 13th discoveries we've made in the western desert in 2011.
Yet while most of Egypt's oil and gas is used domestically, some is exported, and Egypt's gas exports to Israel are hugely controversial. Angus Blair says since the revolution, the pipelines in the Sinai have been attacked 5 times.
It is of concern to a lot of people, not just the hydrocarbon sector, because it's very important in terms of revenues for Egypt that the gas pipeline keeps flowing.
But Blair says the Egyptian government implemented a new strategy to protect its gas. They're now paying Bedouin tribesmen to stand guard. In Cairo, I'm Julia Simon for Marketplace.
Let's do the numbers. European markets are mixed right now. We're going to get an update a little later this morning on consumer confidence. Some positive consumer spending numbers yesterday sent Wall Street stocks much higher. The Dow slapped on 254 points to close at 11,539.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Allianz, providing investment, insurance, and retirement solutions through its affiliated companies in the U.S. since 1896. AllianzUSA.com. And by CenturyLink, a new kind of broadband company linking Americans coast to coast with consistently fast speeds and personal service. More at CenturyLink.com. Healthcare coverage is supported in part by the California Endowment, a health foundation dedicated to expanding access to health care for all Californians.
The tiny Gulf state of Qatar has a population of just 1.7 million, but it beat the United States to host the Soccer World Cup in 2022, and this week it says it's going to bid for the 2020 Olympics. Now, Qatar's ambitions go well beyond the sports field and into the battlefield of Libya. From Dubai, the BBC's Simon Atkinson reports.
Qatar sent money, weapons, and expensive fighter jets to the Libyan rebels during the uprising. In fact, Qatar's capital Doha has become something of a home away from home for Libyan opposition leaders. Dean is a TV producer working for a Free Libya TV satellite channel that broadcasts out of Doha. She thinks Libyans will always be grateful for Qatar's support.
For different reasons, you know, the Arab world has not been able to step up. But Qatar is, I would say, an exception.
So what does Qatar want in return? Well, clearly now it's going to have some political influence. But there are potential economic benefits too. Qatar-based companies are going to be well positioned to win lucrative construction contracts. And that's because Libya is going to be spending money to rebuild infrastructure battered by airstrikes. The Libyan rebel government already said it's going to tap their regional allies to help sell their vast oil and gas supplies. In Dubai, I'm the BBC's Simon Atkinson for Marketplace.
And finally, an Australian man has learned the hard way. Don't store your wife's expensive gold jewelry in garbage bags. The man put the items in the bags because he wanted to fool any potential robbers. Well, instead, the man fooled himself. And when he threw out the other trash in his house in the same type bags, he threw the jewelry out with it, worth about $53,000. Now, because the guy didn't realize what he'd done until a couple of days later, garbage collectors say there's no telling where the prized bag wound up. The good news, though, is gold is down from its record highs earlier this month. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles. We're online at marketplace.org. This is the Marketplace Morning Report. And this is APM, American Public Media.
Ask a platoon of Marines why go green, you're going to get a lot of this.
I mean, come on. Like, seriously, it's not an environmental thing. It's all about trying to help us accomplish a mission.
Guns versus batteries. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tactical trade-offs when troops use green tech. It's next time on Marketplace. We'll have the numbers from Wall Street as well. It's from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.